This is just, well, not just for fun, but kind of for fun. This is a story that I'd like to share with you. Sort of a story. You have to imagine that you're a biology class, and I'm the biology professor. All right? Can you handle that this morning? Welcome, class, to Biology 201. In the coming semester, we'll be studying many things, but there's something I want to get out of the way right here and now. I'm talking about the question of where babies come from. Yes, I know. Now, before you get all uptight, I know this is a controversial question and an emotional one, but this is biology class, and we're going to deal with this subject in the clear, cold light of scientific fact. It's high time someone answer this question for you once and for all. So, where do babies come from? It's an age-old problem that even the youngest people wonder about, and most adults, frankly, are too untrained to answer scientifically. As a result, all kinds of old wives' tales have arisen on the subject. After all, when human beings are so ignorant of their very beginnings, they're bound to develop superstitions and legends to fill in the gap. But in this era of frankness and honesty, let's not beat around the bush or feel embarrassed. Let's delve instead right into the heart of the controversy. Since the dawn of history, and no doubt before, man has tried to answer the question of where babies come from, and practically every culture on the globe has some birth myth in its earliest writings. The specifics of these myths vary, but for some reason, a common thread runs through nearly all of them, and that thread has come to be known as childrenism. That's right, children. According to this primitive notion, babies come from parents. In other words, babies are the children or offspring of adults. Yes, I realize this theory sounds silly to us today, but we must remember that this explanation was concocted by people who had never heard of science or medicine or even aerosol spray cans. Indeed, they worked with what they had, which was precious little. What? You want the details of childrenism? Well, okay, the specifics are hardly worth getting into, except to say that it relied heavily on the idea of a pre-existent parent. That's right, adults who actually produced the baby. That in itself is enough to discredit the theory right there. After all, who were these parent beings? And how did they come to be? And how could they have fabricated a baby? The whole idea sounds ridiculous, and rightly so. To understand why the primitives believed in parents, we must realize that they desperately wanted to believe. According to childrenism, parents were wonderful beings who produced babies as expressions of love and then lovingly cared for and protected them. Moreover, these parent beings were superior to babies in nearly every way. Stronger, taller, wiser, more self-sufficient. No wonder early man wanted to believe in parents. By doing so, he made the world seem like a more loving, caring, safe place. And that's not all. Childrenism held that babies were brought forth in their parents' image. The early man thus could feel important and accepted, believing that he was much like his pre-existent powerful father or mother. Yes, it is rather humorous. I know. Very well. We can see that while primitive man was thought that parents made babies, exactly the opposite was true. Babies concocted the idea of parents. Unable to explain in scientific terms the strange new world in which they found themselves, babies came up with the idea of childrenism. Now, we might think that such an obviously wrong-minded theory would be quickly discarded, but that was hardly the case. For thousands of years, childrenism in its various forms prevailed, and countless other superstitions were based upon it. But then came the age of enlightenment. Several courageous scientists broke with tradition and gave themselves to careful study of the question. They were jeered by the primitives, but they labored on. Finally, after years of work, they answered the question that had intrigued humanity for eons. Their answer came to be known as, drumroll please, the theory of chance. Even today it is called a theory, though every respectable scientist on the globe accepts it as absolute fact. A handful of primitives still cling to childrenism and rail at the enlightened scientific community, but the civilized world has largely come around to the truth, and that's why we're here today. To discover the truth. So, you ask, where do babies come from? Well, the theory of chance is rather difficult and complex if your mind is not trained, but I can summarize it. Basically, the theory explains that babies come to be through through a variety of random means. There is no intelligent, powerful, pre-existent being who produces them. They just happen. For some, babies are brought by a large, long-legged bird called a stork. That's S-T-O-R-K. If you'd like, I can write it on the board. It's not clear where the stork comes from, but scientists are working on that. Suffice it to say that the bird wraps the infant in a sling made of cloth, takes the ends of the cloth in its long beak, flies with its burden to a populated area, and there chooses a house completely at random and drops the cloth-wrapped baby down the home's chimney into the occupant's waiting arms. For others, the baby comes from a different source. Those who want to have a baby travel to an agricultural area and find a cabbage patch. After obtaining the farmer's permission, the would-be baby possessors enter the cabbage patch and walk up and down the rows looking under cabbage leaves. When an infant is found under one of the leaves, the adult picks it up and takes it home with them. Still others find their baby at the hospital. Arriving during visiting hours, the adults go to a place called the maternity wards, where a selection of infants is kept behind a large glass window. Adults line up in front of the window and choose a baby to take home with them, often picking the one they think most resembles themselves. This is definitely the most expensive method, with adults sometimes paying the hospital thousands of dollars for the infant of their choice. Oh, there are other ways, all covered by the theory of chance, including babies left in cradles by elves and fairies, babies deposited on doorsteps, babies who grow on trees. The important thing is to remember that regardless of the arrival, the means of arrival, babies just happen. Write that down in your notes. There is no rhyme or reason to the process, and certainly no apparent being who creates the offspring. Such superstitions as childrenism are best left in the dark ages where they belong. Well, that about wraps it up for today. What's that? You have a question? No, my wife and I do not have any children. No, I do not know why. Any other questions? No? Class dismissed. Now, that is humorous, but also serious. What is childrenism, by the way? No, childrenism. But you're right on target. Creationism. Creationism versus those who would believe something that maybe we'll call philosophical naturalism. The idea that there is no supernatural being out there, which therefore precludes the biblical account of creation. I pointed out a couple weeks ago when we were looking at, it's been a month ago now, whatever it was, when we were looking at what the Bible has to say about the final end of the wicked, that a man by the name of Charles Darwin was motivated by the Christianity that he encountered to write a worldview that would allow him to be intellectually consistent and not believe in God. You recall, if I could paraphrase his quote again, he said, "I can't understand why anyone would wish Christianity to be true. If it is, then my father and many of my closest friends are going to burn in hell for eternity. And that is a damnable doctrine." And I would have to say amen. But where Darwin went with it was to produce one of the most influential texts in support of what we now might call philosophical naturalism. The single, probably single most powerful competing worldview to the biblical worldview in the Western world. Darwin's ideas have been accepted by an amazing number of people, maybe not fully accepted, but partly accepted at least, in the Western world in a very short period of time when you consider how many thousands of years deity was the assumed explanation for the existence of anything. Darwin's ideas have been accepted by both kinds of atheists. Remember, we talked about two kinds. Hedonistic atheists. These are people who want to do what they want, and so they don't want there to be a God. because then they would be accountable to someone, and protest atheists, people who have seen such a horrific picture of God portrayed to them by those who claim to believe in Him that they would rather not believe in God than believe in a God like that. And many of Darwin's ideas have even been incorporated or bought into by religious people, by people who profess Christianity and say they believe in Jesus and the doctrines and teachings that he taught. We'll consider that in a little more detail partly today. Today, I want to address just one of the lines of reasoning used by people who hold to some form of philosophical naturalism or Darwinian evolution. And it was addressed with some sarcasm in our introductory story. I'm talking about the idea that newer is better. Is newer better?
Not always.
All right, we got not always, sometimes, it depends. And I think you're absolutely correct. But did you notice in the flow of argument here, the biology professor, a lot of references to primitive, those people, that ancient, I can't understand why that held on so long. But now we're enlightened. Now we know better. And in conversations I've had with people who differ with me on this issue, when they find out that I'm a creationist, they say, oh, well, we'll just have to agree to disagree about that. And often I get the impression from people that, well, we're enlightened now, and I can't really believe that somebody like you, an intelligent person, could still hold on to those old-fashioned ideas. But is it really true that just because evolutionary theory is newer, that it is better? Well, let's consider just in general. When I took my car in to get the transmission issue checked out, one of the first things they discovered, well, they told me it's probably an electrical problem, and one of the first things they discovered is that my battery had a dead cell. I don't know if that means anything to all of you, but it means the battery was not functioning on all four cylinders, if you catch the idea. It was a couple pancakes short of a stack, yes. Well, and I mean, I'm using four cylinders in the engine sense, but... And so, I replaced the battery. It didn't fix the problem, but in the case of a busted battery, newer is certainly better. I'm less likely to get stuck on the side of the road someplace because my battery is malfunctioning now than I was with the old battery. And all kinds of examples we can think of. Newer is definitely better. When things get old and wear out, you replace them with something newer. However, one of the other things they told me is that the oxygen sensors might be contributing to the electrical problem. So, and with lacking any better diagnosis, I went down to the auto parts store and replaced both my oxygen sensors. They were not free. They did not convince the transmission to operate any better than it had been before. Now I have two aftermarket oxygen sensors, in my view, aftermarket meaning they're not the original equipment that was in the vehicle, they may or may not be better than what was in there, since what was in there was working perfectly fine. And even if they are better in the short term, it was a waste. I didn't need them. What I had was working fine. Newer is not necessarily better. How about this one? For a time in the 1930s and 40s, this procedure was at the forefront of neurosurgery. It was new. It was a brilliant idea, viewed by the medical establishment as a cutting-edge treatment for mental illness. Before the introduction of antipsychotic drugs or the popularization of psychotherapy, it was touted as the miracle cure for anything from schizophrenia to postnatal depression. You know what this is? Frontal lobotomy. If you want to read a horror story sometime, Is it James Dully, I think is the name of the guy, who's 59 today. When he was 12 years old, he was a little bit of a recalcitrant kid. His parents took him in. The psychiatrist prescribed a frontal lobotomy, and he was one of the, I think he was one of the first people to have basically an ice pick lobotomy. He's 59 years old today, a bus driver, and has lived his entire life wondering who he would be if his parents had not had that done to him. It was the latest and greatest new idea. Is newer better?
No.
Certainly not in this case. Well, then we have to talk about this idea. I'll explain the slide in just a little bit. Spontaneous generation. A very old idea, actually. Spontaneous generation replaced with a new idea relatively recently. Now, spontaneous generation is the idea that if you there are actually recipes for this. If you mix together some grain, some dirty rags in a jar and put them in a dark place for a couple of weeks, you can create from nothing mice. And this was common sense. You know, everybody knew that that was where mice came from. Likewise, maggots spontaneously generated out of rotting meat. The ideas go back at least as far as the 6th century B.C. I mean, we have written records of people writing about this stuff clear back at that time. Famous scientists, clear up to the time of Sir Isaac Newton, believed this. Right? It was just, this was common sense understanding of how reality worked. The idea was replaced with a new idea. And actually quite a few new ideas. But specifically, we could talk about modern germ theory in the late 19th century. But a little before that, and I don't have a slide for it. We'll talk about this slide in a second. But a little before that, a guy named Spallanzini. Where's his name here? Yeah, Spallanzini. Oh, no, this is even before Spallanzini. I can't remember the name of the guy. I'd have to look it up again. Took rotting meat, or took some meat, and put it in three jars. One with an open top, one with a solid lid, one with gauze on top. Because he figured that the maggots came from flies landing on the meat and laying eggs. So to test his theory, this was the experiment he devised. And sure enough, where do you think the maggots showed up? Only in the open container. No maggots in the closed container or the one with gauze on it because the flies couldn't get in. Well, people rejected his experiment, saying he was biased and all kinds of things. You know why? Because a certain segment of the population, at least, thought that spontaneous generation was evidence of the existence of God. See, God is still at work creating in our modern world today. And you take that away from me, that was a big, you know, proof of the existence of God. And so they were offended that someone would suggest that this isn't really what's going on here. Spallanzini, later, the way he devised experiment was people, in order to prove that spontaneous generation happens, would take a flask of broth and say, well, boiling kills all the life in here. So they would boil it and then leave it sit there for a couple more weeks and, you know, it would be full of microbes again in just a short time. And they'd say, see, we killed everything in there. And here it's come back, spontaneous generation. So Spallanzini decided he was going to cook that thing and then seal the glass beaker off by melting the top together. And guess what happened? Nothing grew in it. See? No spontaneous generation. Well, his opponents came back and said, well, duh, because there's no air in there. And you need spontaneous generation for air. You need air for spontaneous generation. It's one of the essential ingredients, like the, you know, the dirty rags in the jar and the old grain, right? That's one of the ingredients. You got to have air. No, nothing can live without air. So even if stuff did spontaneously generate in there, you'd never know because it died immediately. So Pasteur came up with the experiment that you see on the screen in order to do in their argument. He made a flask that was open to the air through a curved outlet. And he figured that way, no one could say they don't that the critters in there don't have air. But likewise, he figured that anything that was floating around in the air would not make it through the curved opening to the flask and get into the solution. So he took his curved flask, he boiled it until it was sterile, and then he set it there for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, months. Nothing ever grew in it. Nothing. But then he figured, probably the microbes floating around in the air have gotten into the neck of my flask. And so he tried dipping the flask like this so that the soup would wash into that neck area. He didn't pour it out. He didn't put anything else in. He just dipped it so that the microbes in the neck could get into the soup. And sure enough, in a matter of days, microbial soup again. And this experiment was easily tested by anybody else and in a relatively short period of time put spontaneous generation out of business for good. And it was replaced with a new idea. Modern germ theory. Is that a good thing? Is newer better in this case? Absolutely. It led to all kinds of advances from simple things like putting your food in the refrigerator to, you know, canning and sealing and packaging and all kinds of things that make our lives easier, keep us safer. Pasteur discovered in a related process that if you cook things to a certain temperature, you can kill off the bad microbes that it will cause it to spoil. We call that pasteurization. And I didn't realize this before, but pasteurization is not sterilization. Did you know that? When they cook stuff, if you sterilize it, it will actually spoil faster once you open it than if you pasteurize it. Chet was telling us this morning, that with pasteurization, they just cook it long enough to kill off most of the bad stuff, and you leave hopefully a majority of the good microbes in there. Because once you open a package, say, of pasteurized milk, all kinds of stuff is going to get in there from the air. You know, microbes will get in there. And if it's a totally sterile environment, the bad ones go, woohoo, and they take over, and it'll spoil in a much shorter period of time. So you want to leave some of the good microbes in there so you've got a population occupying the place. Reminds me of Jesus' parable about the man who, you know, had the demons kicked out of his house but didn't refill the house with anything better. Anyway, pasteurization. All kinds of wonderful things have come about with a new idea. However, it just strikes me as ironic that at the very time spontaneous generation was being laid to rest, you know when Pasteur's paper on this was published? Any guesses? 1859. You know what else was published that year? The Origin of Species. The very same year that spontaneous generation was laid to rest, a worldview that at some level requires it was being formed. Now, I have to be fair to those who buy into philosophical naturalism. They would say that they don't need spontaneous generation as Pasteur disproved it to exist. They're not trying to resurrect, you know, mice appearing in jars with old green and rags. And they're not trying to suggest that we just haven't watched enough flasks, Pasteur's flasks, to see spontaneous generation happen. They would admit that what Pasteur proved is that modern microbes, right, the kind of life that we know today, does not spontaneously generate under any known conditions in which we've been able to observe it. They would say, however, that that does not prove that some other form, more primitive form of life, could not have spontaneously generated from non-life under conditions in the early Earth which we are not able to observe. And while I don't buy their whole where they go with that, that's accurate. Pasteur proved that microbes, as we know them today, do not spontaneously generate in the environment as we know it today. He didn't prove that it couldn't have happened millions of years ago in the early Earth. However, the likelihood of such happening is still infinitesimally small, so small that some folks who are philosophical naturalists such as Dr. Crick of DNA fame. Many of you have heard of Watson and Crick. These were the guys who got the credit. There's a story going around now that they actually had a lab assistant who really did the work, a female, and she never got any credit for it. But these are the guys who got the credit for discovering the double helix structure of DNA, right? As in the illustration you see on the screen. And Dr. Crick, after seeing this, was so astounded at the intricacy of what he saw that he could no longer intellectually believe that under any known or foreseeable conditions on planet Earth, this sort of life could spontaneously generate. And he now is a firm advocate of what is called panspermia. Basically, it's the belief that planet Earth was seeded with life by aliens from outer space. To which I can partly say a hearty amen. And without trying to be obnoxious about it, I think that I could tell you who those intelligent beings from outer space were. Let us create man in our image, in our likeness. Now, the reality is that scientists are working feverishly to recreate the conditions of early Earth. And they're designing experiments to show that primitive life may have been able to spontaneously generate here under those conditions. There are other scientists who have set up massive radios to listen for alien life forms in outer space. A lot of that is driven by the idea that maybe those aliens out there deposited life on this planet at some point in the past. There's been a lot of hubbub recently about the Mars exploration, looking for the presence of organic compounds, just in case those beings also deposited some life on the other planets in our solar system. If life could not spontaneously generate under any known conditions here on planet Earth, if you're a philosophical naturalist, you have to believe that it spontaneously generated somewhere else under different conditions. And that maybe the intelligent beings that arose from that put together a DNA-based life form and planted it here on Earth. The reality is that all of these efforts are driven by a preconceived idea, by an assumption that there is no God. And it is not less reasonable, just looking at the world around us, to believe the creation account of the Bible. You do not have to be stupid or naive or hopelessly out of date to believe the creation account of the Bible. The reality is, a lot of old things are still true. We'll come to that one in a second. When we grow up, we often see the wisdom of old folks that we thought were stupid when we were small. I've read this before, but just for fun, we'll read it again. My father, when I was 4. My daddy can do anything. When I was 5. My daddy knows a lot. At 6. My dad is smarter than your dad. At 8. My dad doesn't know exactly everything. At 10. In the olden days, when my dad grew up, things sure were different. At 12. Oh, well, naturally, father doesn't know anything about that. He's too old to remember his childhood. At 14. Don't pay any attention to my dad. He's so old-fashioned. At 21. Him? He's hopelessly out of date. At 25. Well, dad knows a little bit about it. But then he should, because he's been around for so long. At 30. Maybe we should ask Dad what he thinks. After all, he's had a lot of experience. At 35, I'm not doing a single thing until I talk to Dad. At 40, I wonder how Dad would have handled it. He was so wise and had a world of experience. At 50, I'd give anything if Dad were here now so I could talk this over with him. Too bad I didn't appreciate how smart he was when I could have learned more from him. Here's the principle. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. If what you believed was accurate, changing your mind is a bad idea. It can only go downhill from there. Remember the snake back in the garden told Adam and Eve, you need to upgrade to the newest and latest software. You're missing something. Check this out. If you eat the fruit, you'll become smarter, wiser. The operating system God installed in you is out of date. Was it? No, there was absolutely nothing wrong. They didn't need to fix what God had made perfect and complete. And so any deviation from what they already knew was all downhill. And it was a whole lot more expensive than a couple of oxygen sensors. It is a circular claim for philosophical naturalists to say that newer is better. Right? Because we're evolving and getting better and more complex and smarter and wiser. Therefore, evolution is true. You follow what I'm saying? It's circular to say newer is better, therefore you should believe what's newer. What if the old thing was true? You know, the biblical worldview says that God made us perfect and that things have gotten worse since then. So if I don't buy the idea that we're evolving and getting better, there's no reason why I should be ashamed at holding on to something old. If I already agree with you that ideas have an expiration date like milk, you know, just because the idea is old, eventually an idea gets old and wears out, and you might as well throw it out. Then I don't need to be convinced that I need to stay up to date. But if I believe that the best ideas only get better with age, then telling me I'm out of date is foolish. Perhaps I don't want to trade in my expensive aged wine for last year's vintage. I'm not advocating the drinking of alcohol, but you understand what I'm talking about. There are things that get better with age. Then you trade them in for something newer, and people go, what's wrong with you? Maybe I don't want to trade in my beautiful old Model A for the latest sports car. Some things can't be replaced. Some things are going to continue to get more valuable with age. Maybe I don't want to trade in the wife of my youth for a newer model. Good plan. Absolutely. Newer is not always better. The ancients recognized that something that has shown the ability to stand the test of time is more likely to be true than something that has just appeared on the scene. In the time of Josephus, this is 1st century AD, people attacked the Jewish religion. Romans, right, whose religion was ancient, all the pantheistic stuff they believed in, they could trace back for a long way. They attacked Judaism as a newfangled idea. That there's only one God. And you know how Josephus, the Jewish historian, answered them? Yeah, he said, I can trace the roots of my religion back as far or farther than you can. Judaism is an ancient religion too. Something that has stood the test of time is actually more likely to be true than something that's just appeared on the scene. And what's the lifetime of Darwinism? 150 years, 151, if we count 1859. It could be gone next week. You know, an idea like that could fall out of favor. Lobotomy was around for, you know, a decade or two. When you look at it in the big scheme of things, naturalistic, philosophical naturalism hasn't been around an awful lot longer than lobotomy. Now, that doesn't prove that everything that's old is true. Right? Spontaneous generation was around for an awful long time. And I don't believe that. But just because something is newer doesn't make it truer. Thus says the Lord, stand by the ways and see, and ask for the ancient paths, where the good way is, and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. But they said, no, we want something new. How about Jesus? Did Jesus believe the creation account? Or did he need something new? And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them made them, from the beginning made them male and female? That's enough to answer the question. He's quoting from the creation account to prove his point. This is how God made it. Would you give another one? For those days will be a time of tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the creation, which God created. Until now, and never will. If it's good enough for Jesus, how does the song go? It's good enough for me. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying every innovation is bad, by any means. But I am saying that just because something is new doesn't make it better. How about Paul? For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so they are without excuse. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Remember Adam and Eve? They bought a lie. And it's all been downhill from there. Paul believed in the creation account. I'd like to be in good company with Jesus and Paul. Now, this is just kind of for fun. Well, not exactly just for fun. But I'm taking some scriptures from some different places to make a point. Jesus made this comment, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. At one point, he was actually dealing with some people on the issue of... Well, I don't remember what the issue was right there. But he was basically saying, who you are is going to come out in your words. And if you're a nasty person, it'll come out your mouth. And if there are good things in your heart, that's what will come out your mouth. So, just leaving that there, I got myself curious, what is in God's heart if out of the abundance of his heart, his mouth speaks? There's a million places we could go to find out what's in God's heart, but I like this one. But God, being rich in mercy, right? He's abundant in mercy. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. He's rich in mercy because of his great love. He's rich in love. He has abundant love in his heart. So get this. What happens when God speaks? By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. For he spoke and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast. Out of the abundance of love in God's heart, when he spoke, worlds came into existence. You and I came into existence because God had so much love in his heart that when he spoke, beings who could receive that love and reciprocate that love came into existence. Do you understand what I'm saying? You and I were created because God had too much love to keep to himself. And when he opened his mouth to speak, those who could love and be loved in return came out. This is the biblical worldview. You and I were made on purpose, for a purpose, for love, to love and be loved by a pre-existent being who is stronger and greater and higher than anything we could have imagined if we were just imagining. And you do not have to be naive, foolish, or stupid, or out of date to believe that a being like this could speak the object of His love into existence. I think that's good news.
Amen.
I'm glad to have some documentation, be it very ancient, that makes sense and meaning out of life and existence in this world in a way, well, that makes life worth living. Because if we're just scum from a pond someplace that just happened, if life ever got difficult or painful, what would be the point? But if you've ever experienced the joy and benefits of loving and being loved, you know there's something out there beyond just tooth and claw and nail. And I propose to you today that something is the God of the Bible. And that He loves you and created you specifically so He could love you and be loved.